Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Janae Pierre, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. Coming from New Orleans, I know that the influence of Black people touches many genres of music, including country. Take a listen. We can go all the way back to the great Charlie Pride.
So I've lost the only girl I ever loved.
To Darius Rucker. Yep, that Hootie and the Blowfish guy.
Don't need no five-star reservations. I got spaghetti and a cheap bottle of wine.
To contemporaries like Recy Palmer.
Here comes Sunday morning, palms up in praise, yeah. It's all about my mama naming eyes raised.
A new book looks at the subject of Black country music.
I'm Francesca Royster. I'm the author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions, and a professor of English at DePaul University in Chicago.
Melissa Harris-Perry spoke with Francesca about all things Black country music, including an artist you might not immediately associate with the genre.
All right, can we just start with Tina Turner?
Yes.
So I love what you do here with Tina Turner. In terms of getting us to, you're weaving together these multiple themes, some around Ike and Tina's music, some around Tina's own music, and some of it around, you know, for scholars of Black feminism who will recognize the work of Darlene Clark Hine and Dissemblance. It's a lot to do in a text, but maybe give us a sense of how Tina Turner is telling us a story about Black country music.
Yeah, I would love to do that. Tina is my idol, of course. And I came to Tina after ordering an album on eBay, Tina Turns the Country On. I didn't know that she had recorded a solo album that is completely made of country music covers. And this was an album that was made in 1974. And it was at a point in her life when she was on the verge of leaving Ike Turner. It's kind of a, I really think of it as kind of a freedom, a set of freedom songs for her. She had definitely recorded music referencing herself as a country girl, and Nutbush City Limits is definitely the song that speaks to that, that she recorded with Ike and Tina Review. And in that song, she's really kind of talking about the town that she came from, the sense of kind of everyday rhythms of the town, but also this underlying sense of surveillance. Tina Turner accesses these connections to country life, country living, and also this experience of surveillance sometimes, and then uses them to think about Black female experience, especially the culture of dissemblance, this idea, this mask, you know, that everything is okay, that in fact, you know, everything is copacetic, and sometimes for Tina Turner, the mask of sexual availability is a way of kind of covering or masking this deeper experience. And for me, this country album and the way that it really taps into feeling, deep feeling, and sometimes mourning and grief can be a way of looking behind the mask, which I just think is really magnificent. And sometimes it's she's underestimated in this ability to do that. So yeah, so Tina Turns the Country On. This country album is, includes like a cover of Kris Kristofferson's Help Me Make It Through the Night. She has songs by Dolly Parton and by T.J. Morris. And sometimes these songs are either about rural spaces like the Bayou song, or they're just kind of accessing these ballads, country ballads. And she really gives her own spin on them in ways that I think are surprising and revealing.
To begin our conversation about Black country music with Tina Turner, I think hopefully there were some people who were like, wait, what? talk to me about why it's been difficult to lay claim and to reclaim the long history of country Black folks.
Yeah, because we're definitely there. And, you know, it's just something that I kind of knew deep within me, you know, talking to my family. I knew my grandmother loved country music. And there was a country show that was made in Chicago called the National Barn Dance. And my, you know, my grandmother, who was a Chicagoan, but very, very country herself, loved that music. And, you know, I knew that the banjo was an African instrument and the banjo might be that consummate, the consummate sound of country. And yet I think, like you said, that we, it's been hard to lay claim to it. And some of it has to do, I think, with the history of the ways that country music has been kind of claimed as a soundtrack to authentic white experience. And really as a kind of tool sometimes of white supremacy, depending on whose hands it's in. So definitely in the way that country music has been marketed, you know, from its early years in the 1920s as being hillbilly music, you know, and that is, you know, separated from race music and the blues. There's just this way that it's always been claimed as this white space and white sonic space and even a white physical space where people gather to listen. But when you look beyond that history, you find out the ways that old time music, blues, some of the music that was really appropriated for minstrel shows, like those performative traditions, the instruments themselves, the songs themselves, the stories have been sometimes borrowed and sometimes appropriated, and the roots of Black performers really gets erased. So when Black folks now are encountering country music, they might not know that deeper history of shared roots. And they also have, I think there's kind of a kind of texture of feeling, an archive of feeling that is partly about separation, racial segregation, even racial violence that that country music sometimes has been wrapped up in. And then you add to that the ways that the industry has made it really difficult for Black artists to make it into the mainstream. There's been, you know, an insistence of keeping country music back, Black folk, pretty much to the margins up until very recent times. So all of that, I think, kind of creates this an atmosphere and a culture that has been difficult to claim for Black people.
You know, country music, but also just kind of countryness. I mean, part of what I also love about this book is you write about, you know, it's an scholarly text, right, where you're doing a lot of scholarly theoretical work and reclamation. It's also a little, just enough memoir in there, just enough of your own story that it stays very human for us. And, you know, there are these moments you write about, like you and your sister, you know, just putting on your Tina Turner wigs, or growing up in Nashville and the way that, like, you know, you can't really be from Nashville no matter what your race and not have a certain country about you. It's very much how I feel as a Black Southerner. Like, yeah, I'm a little bit country.
Yeah. Thank you, Melissa. I really, you know, my own roots is, you know, they're from the Black migration, where, you know, just a couple of generations back, there were folks who were deeply country, you know, from Arkansas and Louisiana and Texas. But yeah, also, you know, for myself and my family, for a little while, we were in Nashville, and it's everywhere, in advertisements and field trips and anything. So it was hard not to have a knowledge about country music. And also, yeah, like I had my favorite people that, you know, I liked even as a kid, you know, Dolly, of course. But yeah, and then I think that country music can also speak to the experience of rural life as well. It's not just Southern, but also rural. So in the book, I included a point in my life when I lived in, in a college town in Pennsylvania, but very much connected to rural spaces that I traveled in, and how in that chapter I was writing about Valerie June, and her music became a soundtrack for what it felt like sometimes to navigate the ghosts of racism in, in a state and in a region where Black people once lived but do not live anymore, and just wondering, you know, what happened to the Black people, you know, in central Pennsylvania. So country music has been a way to kind of access that country experience that can be very much Southside Chicago, or can be Nashville, or, you know, even rural Pennsylvania.
Southside Chicago, or as I used to call it when I lived there, oh, this just up Mississippi. It's just
exactly
cold Arkansas. That's all this is.
Exactly.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Melissa and Francesca talk about another artist who has country influences all up in her music.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
Been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We're back with The Takeaway. I'm Janae Pierre, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. We've been listening to Melissa's conversation with Francesca Royster, author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. They also talked about another artist who's reclaiming her country roots and did so on one of country music's biggest nights.
We talked about Tina Turner. You've name-dropped my girl Dolly Parton. But you know we're going to have to talk about Beyoncé.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about the queen, the king bee, and the chicks, and daddy lessons, and sort of what we learn about the politics of Blackness and country music in that moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, well, that premiere of Daddy Lessons on CMT Awards, I think, right? And the performance of Daddy Lessons with the chicks was so timely, because it was, you know, just a few days before the election that eventually yielded our 45. And then, we had the performance of a pop diva, you know, on this determinedly country music space. And they rocked the house. The performance itself is just so wonderful, whether it's like thinking about Beyoncé's divahood, you know, really kind of taking control of the mic and leading the audience, her collaborations with the Chicks. And this was also the Chicks, formerly the Dixie Chicks, return to country music spaces after being boycotted, you know, for their progressive views a few years before. So it was already a really loaded performance, even if it was just the Chicks and them bringing on Beyoncé. And then the song Daddy Lessons itself is really claiming, I argue at least, like a Black outlaw identity, because the daddy in that story is a daddy who, you know, is tough in these ways that a lot of country music daddies are tough, like, claiming the right to arming yourself in self-defense, you know, putting a little whiskey in your tea and no apologies about it. So Beyoncé is really claiming that daddy, which is also, you know, by extension in her performance of it, a Black daddy. And to me, I think it's a really powerful way for a Black woman to think about and maybe even think critically about Black masculinity, violence, like some of the appeal of some of those visions, but also a way to think about the presence of violence as well in the Black community. But in that performance, I think what she is doing is claiming Black Texas Southern girlhood and womanhood. And the response, I think, was sometimes enthusiastic, but also there was tension there. And Natalie Maines has even written about the fact that she will not return, you know, to this award show anymore because of the treatment that Beyonce got, you know, in this space backstage from other country artists.
Yeah, this when it's your Black daddy telling you to exercise your Second Amendment, yes. It definitely it brings a politics with it, right? And right. A politics of a kind that, you know, in order to face it, you have to face a whole bunch of different aspects of violence, right? Gendered violence and racial violence. And as you point out, in that moment, the realities of both existing and future political violence.
Yeah. To me, it just gave an opportunity to think about the convergence of those things, which is something that I think Beyonce in her career has done, you know, in that whole Lemonade album, which I know you've also written about. She's really accessing the history of violence on Black people as well as against Black people, but also, you know, interpersonal violence and how, you know, racism and white supremacy and a culture of violence also destroys us, you know, in terms of our personal lives and relationships and our sense of self. And so I think Daddy Lessons is just poised at a really interesting place on that album as a way of thinking about, okay, what are these older ideas about like what manhood should be and Black manhood? And then how does that connect to our freedom songs and the ways that we're healing ourselves and healing our relationships? And so it's just interesting to bring in the chicks in that conversation too, because there are also artists who have also talked about violence through Goodbye Earl. That's it.
Let's go ahead and mosey on down the old town road with Lil Nas X.
My pleasure.
I got the horses in the back. Horse stock is attached. Head is matted black. Got the boots black to match. Riding on a horse.
We're in a space that is Black country and queer. Let's talk about this.
Yes. Well, I love Lil Nas X because of his boldness and his queerness and the ways that, you know, as he was taking on country music and some of the gatekeepers of country music, he also chose that time to come out, you know, as a gay man. And I think that it's incredibly brave, and his tools for doing that are, you know, his own outrageousness and his sense of humor, which I think you can kind of find in Old Town Road itself. Like I really hear that song as, you know, a song about, you know, just wanting to kind of find a kind of escape, a kind of safe place, but also really kind of taking the traditions of the cowboy and the strength of the cowboy and lend a hand to this desire to kind of come out, basically. So I think it's a really beautiful song. And then later with Montero, he totally takes up space and brings out his own queerness and unapologetically takes on the criminalization of queerness and gayness in that album. So I think he's just a really wonderful and thoughtful artist. And sometimes he's characterized as someone who, you know, is kind of a dismissible pop icon. But I really find that he's very intelligent and very funny in the ways that he's bringing his critical eye in ways that feel also very queer.
Why does it matter? What difference does it make to lay claim to and amplify this experience of Black country music?
Hmm. That's a great question. Well, some of it is really thinking about, you know, our history as Black people in the United States, our contributions to the musical landscape and the ways that, you know, I feel like in the marketing of music, sometimes we are pushed to the edges of things. And that is an issue of finances, and it's an issue of imaginative freedom. So I think that is one reason that it matters, because we should all feel free to make and occupy any kind of musical space that we want, but also lay claim to a history that is part of the ingenuity and creativity of an art form. And country music is one of those things. And when I was writing this, I really had my daughter in mind, who doesn't have the kind of, nose in her head that I think adults have about what kind of music is cool. I mean, she has her own personal tastes, of course, but she doesn't feel shame or this feeling like this is too country for me or this is too white for me. And I really hope that she keeps that spirit. And I think that's, to me, watching her exercise her freedom in whatever she's interested in is something that I really hope for everybody. But that does take recovery work, and it takes creating spaces of safety sometimes for fans and also for performers. And it takes, you know, talking about the history and getting it out there and thinking about, you know, it's not natural. This is not a natural segregation of this musical form. It's totally circumstantial, and it's about power and history.
Francesca Royster, author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Take good care.